I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The mysterious affliction known as autism is emerging out of nightmare territory into the news. Autism is the affective disorder with many symptoms, identified typically in children around the age of 2 or 3, when they can seem isolated from other people's emotions, when their language skills stop developing, when they start fixing on a single subject or gesture, which may be headbanging. For years, autism was commonly and wrongly attributed to refrigerator moms or outright abuse. Then it was confidently labeled a genetic disease. The news is twofold. First, that the incidence of autism is rising in startling proportions. The number of Florida school children with autism today is 6 times what it was 10 years ago. A state study in California shows nearly a 3-fold increase in 10 years. But secondly, there are numerous new theories about the cause of autism coming out of manifold research projects and also coming off internet conversations among scientists and parents. Our guest Karen Cerussi has written one very resourceful parent's account of her son Miles's autism and her own penetration of the professional confusion around the disease. We're also joined by one of the leading Boston doctors in the field. Dr. Karen Munir is a child psychiatrist and epidemiologist who runs the Center for Autism at Children's Hospital in Boston. Connection listeners, what's your experience with this frightful disease and with the scientific and human struggle to understand it? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Do we know what kind of brain injuries cause autism? And what is the hope of biogenetic medicine in treating it? 1-800-423-TALK makes the autism connection. Karen Cerussi's book is called Unraveling the Mystery of Autism and Pervasive Developmental Disorder. Karen Cerussi, welcome to The Connection.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'd love you to tell your story briefly about Miles, but then particularly tell us what you learned in fighting with it.
Well, when I received the diagnosis of autism in 1995 for my son, it was not something that I was at all familiar with. I think most people, until it happens to their own family, really don't pay much attention to things like that. But I was under the impression that it was very rare, that it was extremely... I even thought that there might be an emotional or psychological component to it. But luckily, I got to the library, I started doing some research, and I found that although there was no effective cure or treatment for it, that at least it was considered to be some kind of genetic hardwired brain abnormality. It did mean, though, that my son was going to be severely impaired, both socially and intellectually, for life. And it was a very devastating diagnosis. What my husband and I did, he's a PhD research scientist, and I am a writer, and so the two of us just started researching our heads off. And, of course, in 1995, one of the most apparent sources that I needed was the Internet, which turned out to be a real blessing. But
I want to get to the whole matter of the Internet. Sorry, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was when I was grasping at straws in those early stages, it occurred to me that my son might have a milk allergy because he was consuming large quantities of milk, about 70 to 80 ounces a day, which is more than half a gallon a day by himself, and he screamed if he didn't get it. And there were other reasons why I thought he had a milk allergy, but when we removed dairy products from his diet, we began to see an immediate difference in the amount of eye contact that he was making, in his awareness of others. It was fairly striking, and so... I bought that modem. I sat there and took my computer apart and figured out how to hook up the modem, and I got on the Internet and I said, does anybody on this autism list know why my son might be responding to having milk taken out of his diet? Could that be causing his autism? And even back in 95, I got about 40 letters from parents who said yes, from all over the world, from Norway and Sweden and England, saying, yes, we have seen the same thing and we don't understand it, but it definitely seems to be true. And then luckily we got in touch with some researchers in Europe who had found preliminary evidence to show that the proteins in dairy and also in gluten, which is a wheat protein, were not being properly broken down in these children. And so removing those proteins could actually really affect their behavior. So we immediately took gluten out of my son's diet, and this was all shortly after his diagnosis at 19 months old. And by the time he was 2, it was apparent to me that he was going to be okay. It took about 2 years of intensive rehabilitation and one-on-one therapy before he was socially and cognitively normal or caught up with his peers. But he's by the time he was three, he lost his diagnosis. He lost all services. And at six, he's in a regular first grade class and doing absolutely beautifully. He's popular. He's got friends. He's funny. And he's one of the smartest children in the class. So we narrowly escaped a very, very bad situation.
Well, now, you haven't even mentioned what you think could be a major villain here, which is vaccination.
Well, you know, it's what I believe, and this is after very careful interpretation of what I've heard and seen and studied, is that autism is an immunological disorder, which means that there's something goes awry with the immune system at some point early in life. And I think that, yes, the predisposition toward that may be genetic, but we really are seeing an epidemic right now, and I've never heard of a genetic epidemic, although I'm sure someone would try to prove me wrong. It seems to me that what's happening is that a lot of children who may have had a predisposition for this, it never would have been triggered had they not experienced some kind of immune insult. I believe because of the temporal relationship, the relationship in time between the MMR vaccine and my son's onset of autism, and this is a story I've heard from so many, hundreds and hundreds of parents, that for some children it's possible that a viral load or a vaccination, a combination vaccination, may be what's pushing them over the edge.
Well, no, just one sec. Just clarify that. MMR is measles, mumps, rubella.
Yeah, measles, mumps, and rubella.
But
and
why,
they give them all three together to, just for convenience, really.
How did that combine with what you concluded were the milk and gluten triggers of his condition?
Well, that was the big mystery in my book, because I started writing it when it became apparent to me that we were on something, onto something with the diet. But throughout the book, I kept saying, why the heck would this vaccination, which my son developed normally, and I think what I'm talking about for the most part is this late onset autism we're seeing in a lot of children, where they develop normally for a period of time, and sometime in the second year of life, they lose all language and social skills. And for my son, it happened within the 3 weeks of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. So, you know.
Well, what's the connection between, in your view, between MMR and the gluten and the milk?
Well, I didn't know that connection, and I wondered and wondered and wondered. And then in 1998, there was a British researcher who published a paper in The Lancet stating that he had found some evidence. He had found a unique pattern of bowel disease in autistic children, late-onset autism with gastrointestinal symptoms, which described my son, and that he had found evidence of chronic measles infection in the gut. Now, what we understand about this is still unclear, and frankly, this was a preliminary study. I know that he has studied over 150 other children, and despite the fact that doctors are running around in the CDC and the British National Health Service are running around saying that his study has been disproven, there's no way it can be true, he's continued to find this unique pattern of bowel disease in autistic children. And so at this point, my suspicion is that this chronic viral infection is compromising the integrity of the gut, and it's allowing these proteins to leak into the bloodstream undigested. It could also be that for some reason it's caused an enzyme deficiency in these kids. But for a large percentage of children, and especially the ones who have late-onset autism and gastrointestinal symptoms, this diet does seem to alleviate the symptoms of autism, and sometimes quite dramatically.
Karen Cerusi, stand by. This is an important story about kind of a bootstrap medical degree, what an active parent can do with an important, I mean, incredibly important conclusion that autism in many cases may be treatable, that moms can fight the doc successfully, that vaccines could be involved. I want to get Dr. Karim Munir's big picture view here on all of those issues, including this question of internet as a kind of activist's clinic on its own. But I'd also like you to start with the general news that autism seems to be epidemically on the rise. Dr. Munir.
Well, this is a complicated question that we have been struggling with. Thank you very much for inviting me to talk to you about
the
subject. Yes. I want to make a distinction between the question of the rise of prevalence rate versus the incidence. And this is a distinction in epidemiological research. Prevalence is really the number of cases at any given time of autism in the population divided by the total number of children in the population, whereas incidence is the number of new cases that are evolving over a period of time for children who are at risk for developing autism. And that's the more complicated. It's like velocity. It's the rate of change of a disorder. And what fuels the changes of incidence is really a scientific question that has always been the domain of epidemiological investigation. And epidemiological studies in autism has been somewhat rare. And I think so we can't really speak very much about the changes in incidence that is a true scientific change in the rate. However, what we gather, I think, from the changes in prevalence rate, that in fact is a suggestion that there has been an increase.
It's not just and increases. I mean, there was a story in the New York Times today about
yes.
Brick Township in New Jersey, fear of clusters. I guess the underlying question would be, do clusters and does a rising rate like this talk you out of a straight genetic disposition as the cause of the disease? Are there environmental factors, including possibly vaccines?
Well, what's happening, I think, is that there is a change in the administrative prevalence of this condition, and this change is very dramatic. And this is not only explained by the changes in terms of our ability to identify these kids and report them administratively, but there is something else going on. And, for example, the Brick Township study, I was looking at the report today, was suggesting that it was 3 to 4 per thousand. That's almost like 1 in 250 kids in this township that had autism. And that's a very high rate indeed. In fact, many of the epidemiological studies have suggested a rate of 1.2, more recently, 1.2 to 1.4 per thousand, which has prompted some, actually recently during the autism rally in the State House past week, to say that it was 1 in 800. And I think that has been the figure that as most people now agree with. However, when you look at like 10 years ago, that rate was 3 or 4 per 10,000. So there is definitely a dramatic increase in the prevalence rate of autism. And this is the core syndrome also. It's not necessarily what we call the pervasive developmental disorder, which is really the broader definitional type of autism that includes many other aspects of this condition. And I think that's important to note as well.
You heard and read Karen Cerussi's account of her own detective work, which fixed on diet, but also on the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination. Where would you be looking for a suspect here for this rise as a cause?
Well, at this point, I don't think we have I think the suggestion is that this, as Karen Cerussi has suggested, that I think that there is another factor besides genetic factors that's fueling this rise in autism prevalence rates, even though we don't know the exact incidence, how much it's risen scientifically. But I think one of the issues really has been, what are these environmental factors? We know that there are a number of perinatal factors that are associated in terms of birth difficulties at birth and postnatal difficulties in autism, or children affected with autism subsequently diagnosed by age 18 months or so. Around this time, around 14, 15 months, these children are given the triple vaccine. And I think this association at that time might be spurious, but has led to this case series that was reported in London by Andy Wakefield at the Royal Free Hospital of 12 children who were affected by this inflammatory bowel disease, of whom some of them were diagnosed with developmental regressions that suggested that they were autistic. However, there has been a larger study that has been conducted subsequently.
And you mentioned Brent Taylor's study?
Yeah, that's right. That Brent Taylor study has suggested that this was a study that looked at the introduction of MMR vaccines in England was in 1988. And this study, the Brent Taylor study in London, which was this large database study, looked at births since 1979. And a number of aspects of this were of interest. One is that they did not find, among the children who were vaccinated versus children who were not vaccinated, a difference in terms of the rates of autism. That's number one. Mm. And number two, in the children between 79 and 88 versus post-88, when the MMR vaccine was introduced there was no association in those who were vaccinated in terms of the autism rates. And this data, I think, was very much noted by many of the public health authorities in England in support of the notion that there is absolutely no association at this time with vaccines and
so you're
autism.
Discounting the vaccine as a suspect.
May I comment on Brent Taylor's study?
Sure.
It's interesting because I'm a layperson, but I do have a scientific background. And when I looked at Brent Taylor's study, there's tremendous criticism of it, and I can absolutely see why, because the first part, as Dr. Munier just mentioned, it was comparing vaccinated children versus non-vaccinated children and their response rate to whether or not there were more autistic children in the vaccinated group. He won't release any of the data or methodology for that part of the study, which I find a bit concerning. Also, I should mention that the study was sponsored by the British National Health Service. And then the second part of the study, which said that there was no correlation in the increase of autism in 1988 when the vaccine was administered, he left out a kind of a vital piece of information, which was that they had a catch-up campaign in Britain when the MMR was introduced. So, for example, the MMR was introduced in 1998. So you would think that there was...
1988.
You would think that there would be an increase in the number of autism cases in children born in 1987 because you vaccinate one-year-olds with the MMR. In fact, there was quite an increase in autism in 1985 and 1986 in Great Britain. And so that would say, okay, well, the increase preceded the administration of the MMR, but that's actually not the case because when the MMR was introduced, they vaccinated birth year 87, birth year 86, and birth year 85, as well as 84 and 83. There was a catch-up campaign. So it is very likely that two-year-olds who were given the vaccine could have become autistic at that point. So as far as I'm concerned, that was a very flawed study. It was sponsored by the British National Health Service, who had a lot to lose by information that there could be a vaccine autism link. And while it certainly doesn't prove things either way, and while Dr. Wakefield's study doesn't prove things either way, I just think we need a lot more open-minded and fair-minded studies before we can rule out this possibility.
Karen Cerusi, I just want to, it's hard to sort of belabor any one particular study in an hour on the radio. You've had a lot of experience with doctors, I'm sure a lot of it frustrating. I wonder, what does the parent of an autistic child want to ask a doctor, specialist, and what do you want to tell a doctor about what they're doing?
Well, I think that the parents of autistic children are very distrustful of their doctors, and it's a shame because together we could do so much more than when we're polarized the way we are now. There are some wonderful doctors out there who will actually make statements like, we don't know too much about this. You go ahead and do your homework, and anything you find that seems of interest, I will try to look at that with an open mind. I've heard of parents who said, look, I've heard that this diet can help certain children with autism. My son seems to fit into that category. I'd like to try it. And their doctors have said, if you do this nonsense, this nutritional alternative medicine with your child, then I won't even be his physician anymore, which is absurd because it's very plausible that autism could be metabolic in nature, among other things. Certainly, speaking from my own experience, I had a child who developed normally until 15 months old, 10 days after what I consider to be a viral load. He was in the hospital with seizures and high-pitched screaming and 106 fever. Within 2 weeks of that date, he lost all social and language skills and began profuse chronic diarrhea and screaming, screaming that was just day and night. It was terrible. The child was suffering horribly, and he was diagnosed with autism. I was told it was a behavioral disorder and that I should be treating the behaviors with therapy and whatever. But as far as I was concerned, I had a very sick little boy. And when I began connecting with other parents on the Internet especially and discovering that this was an extremely common pattern of physical ailments, many of the children had eczema, asthma, terrible multiple food allergies, and this diarrhea or constipation or alternating constipation and diarrhea, it seemed to me that what my doctor should have been looking at was the cause of the disease, not just treating the symptoms. And it was only by doing that I was able to restore my son to health.
Dr. Miller, what do you say to parents?
Well, I think that this is a very devastating and a very, very difficult news. And I think it's very important that these children get full evaluation that is interdisciplinary, that involves team members, that include pediatricians, psychologists, speech and language therapists, psychiatrists, as well as people in the education field who can work with the parents in advocating for the best placement in the educational setting. And early interventions are very important. And it's also very important that these are done in a sustainable fashion and that they're individualized for the child's needs. Because there is tremendous variability in the manifestation of this illness in children. And children have different levels. For example, some children don't have any speech. Some do have some speech. Some children have very interfering behavioral difficulties that need to be addressed. And I think that the increased rate of the prevalence of this disorder has put a lot of pressure in many of the special education departments across our state. And this has led to, you know, a great deal of awareness, particularly among parents of the disorder, because of many other sources, as like the internet, that has led people to actually ask for these services. And we want the best services for these children.
Let me ask you, when a parent says, this has got to be treatable, my kid's going to get over this, what do you say?
Well, I think that absolutely the hope and the fact that there is tremendous variability in this disorder has to be there and sustained by doctors. And parents should be partners in this, I think. And what I also find that earlier the identification of this illness among the children is so important in building this partnership. And I think one of the things that I read in Karen Cerise's book was this issue of this very early awareness of the factors, the great deal of brightness about, you know, how what kind of factors can be actually contributing to this and what needs to be done.
We're talking about autism with Dr. Kerim Munir from Children's Hospital in Boston and Karen Cerise, an active parent. You're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255 is our phone, 1-800-423-TALK. Richard is on the line.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just have a very basic question. I still want to try to know what exactly is autism. I have some ideas based on popular references such as Rain Man, but I'm hoping that your experts can describe the range or gamut of symptoms that would lead to a diagnosis of autism.
Richard, thank you. Dr. Munir.
Well, this is a disorder that has three basic domains of difficulty. The first domain involves the issue of reciprocal social interaction. That is, the child does not show and does not reciprocate social contact with the person who is the immediate caregiver. And one of these manifestations might be, for example, absence of eye contact, or it could be a qualitative lack of eye contact. And the child does not show an interest in others and might have other interests. And this is the second domain that has to do with these recurring stereotyped behaviors the child engages in, like spinning things or being fascinated by spinning things or doing very repetitive things like rocking and other types of things. And this has a tremendous variability. It might actually involve the use of language that might be in stereotype. And that brings me to the third area, which has to do specifically with the speech and language development. And some of these kids have difficulty in gaining their developmental milestones in speech and language and are delayed in speech and language. And this delay might be anything as not having at all any speech to having phrased speech or having very rote speech or some pragmatic difficulties in speech, that is, difficulties understanding abstractions and being very concrete, or having actual difficulties in the production of speech, like having certain intonation difficulties. And
is there any such thing as mild or light autism?
Well, there is such a thing, and in fact, that's one of the things that we always struggle with, and it's called now pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, which is a sort of a sub-threshold form of autism, which is really a working diagnosis. And the child who has not been diagnosed with the full criteria might be given the diagnosis of what we call as PDD-NOS. And this is one of the more common diagnostic findings that are given to children who are seen in clinical settings these days.
Terence Cerussi, I wonder if you want to refine the sort of general description of it, and particularly what led you to think, to believe that this was treatable.
Yeah, I have a very different definition of autism. It's interesting how the doctors are very good at describing the symptoms of autism, but I think you have to ask a parent what the nature of autism is. I don't think autism is a symptom. I think it's a disease or a disorder. I think a description of autism would be, yes, noticeable lack of social skills, lack of intent to socialize or to connect with family members or peers, but I think it's actually, if you said, what is autism, I would say it's an immune system breakdown that results in immune deficiency, in malabsorption, sometimes in gastrointestinal problems, in stomach pain, and sometimes in migraines, and it may be associated with multiple food allergies. So my idea of what is autism is actually changed quite a bit since my son was first diagnosed.
But what got you to believe you could penetrate it?
I think the day that I took dairy out of my son's diet and we started to see a difference, it was so shocking to me. I mean, it was wonderful that he was getting better. He had been getting worse and worse every day seemed to be losing skills. And then one day there was a turning point. It was the day we took dairy out of his diet. And when the doctor said, there's no reason that should happen. This can't possibly be true. When you see something...
Forgive me for interrupting. We're going to take a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Autism Connection. We're talking about an enormously mysterious disease, autism, and one woman in particular's struggle with it. Karen Cerussi's book is called Autism and Pervasive Developmental Disorder. It's the story of how she became a breakthrough diagnostician in the case of her own son, Miles. And the breakthrough was when the first symptoms showed, when he was 19 months old, she took him off an enormous intake of milk and got an immediate response for the better. Karen, finish that story and how the dietary response just changed your whole thinking and geared you up for a long siege here.
Well, I think if people tell you that the solar system revolves around the Earth and all the planets revolve around the Earth, and you sit down in front of your telescope in, the year 1533 and discover that this is just simply not true, it changes a lot of things. It certainly changed a lot of things for me to be told something by a profession that I had enormous respect for and still do have enormous respect for, that was so clearly untrue about my child, that these proteins couldn't have anything to do with his autistic behavior. It became so apparent to me that it wasn't just that my son was an anomaly when I got on the internet and found hundreds and hundreds of other parents who had observed the same thing independently, that removing dairy proteins and gluten proteins, which is a wheat protein, from their children's diet was making an enormous difference. Now, the research that came out about this clearly was preliminary. There were researchers in Europe who found what are called peptides, abnormal peptides, of gluten and dairy in the urine of autistic children. So they'd been excreted, and you can find them there. And they're called casomorphine and alpha-gliadin. That's a milk. That's a morphine-like and opiate-like milk breakdown product and gluten breakdown product. So, if you think, it makes a lot of sense if you think about the fact that these kids exhibit bizarre preoccupations, repetitive behaviors, they lack social skills and often lack the intent to communicate in language if they're on some kind of hallucinogenic, endogenous compound that's in their bloodstream and affecting the brain. So first of all, that explains a lot. It's true. I know it sounds awfully far-fetched, but there's nothing like anecdotal evidence for a parent, which is, you know, you take these foods away, the kid starts to get better. And if the younger they are, the more dramatic this can be. Now, my son was 15 months old when the onset of his autism occurred. He was 19 months old when he was diagnosed, and he was off dairy 2 weeks later. So, you know, for my son, it's actually amazing to me that in 4 months so much damage could have taken place. He had lost all social and language skills, and it took a couple of years of intensive therapy to rehabilitate him. For a child who's 8 or 9 or 10 years old, sometimes you take these foods away and it's like a fog lifting, and it can make an enormous difference for them.
I want to get Dr. Muneer's response. This is an extraordinarily unconventional approach. And it seems to have worked. There's an enormous challenge here to regular medicine. What's the answer? Do you want to caution Karen Cerusi or parents who take this bit in their teeth?
Well, I think that there are children who have allergies and milk sensitivity, gluten sensitivity, and so on, and these cause developmental regressions. And I think that the story that Karen Cerusi describes is one which is really not characteristic of the overall picture of how autism emerges. What she, I think, is very sort of attached to is the notion that she had a very short period of time that she needed to make these changes, and these changes caused the improvement in her son. And I think this is just based on one individual case. And I think it only represents a slice of the pie. I mean, I think her book also represents a slice of the pie of this very large saga of autism. And I think it's very important to put that in that perspective, because many parents are struggling with children who continue to persist to have this disorder and may feel actually terrible about the fact that somehow they missed something, which in fact, as Karen Cerusi herself says, may have been very difficult to identify, because there are some parents that she has talked to who report that their children did not have any of these allergies, but she still has, for example, suggested that, well, they should really be systematically excluding certain dietary components and experimenting with whether, in fact, there will be an improvement, and that they didn't really have that much time to miss. And I think this is a hypothesis that she has, and it's based on her experience, and I think there are other children who have had this problem. My wife has suffered from lactose intolerance, which was missed by a number of doctors for a number of years. And I think what I want to say is that I completely understand these issues of food sensitivity and so on, and what kind of a miserable situation that it can cause. Mm. But I think it's very important for everyone, you know, for all those parents who have children with autism, to put this thing in perspective, in a perspective that really involves very early advocacy for early interventions and the importance of collaborative relationships with the educational and early educational services.
It also reminds me...
That's a very important public health concern, I think.
Doctors and parents applying the what we call the first and second laws of therapeutics. First law is, if what you're doing is working, keep doing it. If the other one is, if what you're doing is not working, try something else. You've done it brilliantly, Karen Cerusi, and we'll know someday.
Thank you. I have to tell you, I run an international support organization for parents of autistic children, and although I think that 10 or 15 years ago the percentage of children who would respond to dietary intervention the way my son did was very small, I think it's by far the vast majority of the kids that we're seeing today, and I think that this subtype of autism may explain the incredible increase that we've seen.
Let's hear from callers. 1-800-423-8255, the Autism Connection. Tracy is calling from Lake Placid, New York.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Tracy.
First of all, I'd like to say that I've been following Karen Cerusi's book with my son, who was diagnosed with PDD-NSO when he was just about 2 years old, shortly after the MMR shots. We read her book. We're a member of the Autism Net Diet program that we've been following. And my question for Karen is, and other parents, too, is the diet is very challenging when you try to travel, or even at home when both parents work. And if there's other things that could be brought out about helping parents with diets for their children. My son had all the symptoms that Karen's son seemed to have had with the diarrhea and stuff. And now that we're on this diet, he was diagnosed over 2 years behind in his developmental development, and now he's only 6 months behind, and we're really seeing some great improvements in my son. We've also had problems, as was mentioned earlier, with the doctors not believing or not supporting what you're doing with your diet, and we were trying all sorts of things to try to help our son once he was diagnosed with this disorder. And it's just, I think, like you just mentioned about trying everything, and if it works, keep going. We've tried everything all at once, and we're not sure what's working either. So that's another problem I think parents need to be cautious about. But I think the diet is really a big thing, and Karen is to be congratulated for her book and her efforts. And thank you.
Tracy, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the Autism Connection. Martha is on the line.
Good morning.
Hello, Martha.
I'm a parent of a daughter now 36 years old who is a person with autism, and let me begin by saying she's terrific. She's fluent in Spanish as well as English, although autistically fluent. I want to refer to Peter Rosenberger, who's a neurologist at Mass General. At least 20 years ago, he made the observation that autism will turn out to be like fever, something with many different causes. And in my work with parents over 25 or 30 years, I would have to say he's absolutely right. I also have noticed throughout my work that there are really at least two major groups of kids with autism. Those like my daughter, who started out from birth. In retrospect, it was clear that she was autistic from birth, and most of them, I think, are in that category. But we do have a second group who seem to develop normally and then, for a variety of reasons, suddenly begin to regress, and that, of course, includes Karen's child. The second point I want to make is that I just completed a year-long study that was funded by our State Department of Education. It was a comprehensive needs assessment, really, of educational services for kids with autism. We surveyed parents, local SPED administrators, and early intervention directors. And the early intervention directors indicated that they are seeing an increase in numbers of children identified with autism and entering their programs. But I want to emphasize that this is kids identified with autism. The SPED administrators pointed out that they, over the last 20 years, have experienced major changes in terminology. And I think for that reason, we need to be very, very cautious, because we do not have hard baseline data, or not from a very long period of time. And in one focus group, there were SPED administrators who commented that children are being termed autistic now who 25 years ago would have been called trainable mentally retarded.
Is this true?
Yes.
I'd love to comment on this.
Okay.
Taryn, go ahead, and then Dr. Muneer.
There's actually been an excellent study done by the California Department of Developmental Services. I think yesterday was the one-year anniversary of the release of that report. You can find it on the web. But what they discovered was that they had very good data from the last 10 years. And categories like mental retardation, cerebral palsies, Down syndrome, they have actually just increased with the population growth, whereas autism has quadrupled or quintupled. And I think you can understand statistically that if autism used to be diagnosed as something else, that those numbers would be going down now, and they're not. These children were not slipping through the cracks. And just to tell you, I know this is really a very small study, but on my street, which has 150 children, it's a nice suburban street in a middle-sized city. We have 6 children with autism, PDD, or Asperger's. 6 out of 150. Now, that's really, I mean, you can sit there and say, well, the CDC says it's 1 in 150, but if that's the case, I've got every kid right there on my street for the whole city. I think it's absurd to sit there saying we don't think there's an increase when I can't sit on a train without finding myself next to the parent of an autistic child or walk down the street without seeing them. They're everywhere now.
Dr. Muneer.
I think that most people agree that there is an increase, and I think the question is, what's fueling that increase? Is it really an administrative increase in service delivery, which is now mandated through federal legislation that these states should report the rates of services for children with autism? And I think if you look at those statewide data from California, Minnesota, and other states that have been published, they show the dramatic rise in the provision services for not only for autism, but in fact much higher rates for pervasive developmental disorders as well. But I think the issue really is, as I was trying to explain earlier, is there really a true rise in the scientific incidence of the condition that's fueled by some other environmental
factor? What do you think?
And I think if you look at the epidemiological studies worldwide, you see that there is an increase in the last 10 years compared with the previous 10 years, but this increase in no way compares with what California is reporting, which is like 200% to 2,000% for PDD. So I think it's important to keep that in perspective. That, and also the question is also, as Martha, I believe, was saying, that that there is an increased awareness of the condition among the very cognitively gifted children as well as adults, as well as there is an awareness of the condition among children with cognitive delays that are significant.
Can we mention why it seems to strike boys so much more heavily than girls?
Well, this is true, and it is also true for Asperger's as well as for autism. The ratio is 2 to 3 to 1 in the population and higher in the referred samples and seen in clinics, maybe like 4 to 5 to even higher. So it is like attention deficit disorder is similar. It strikes boys more than girls. And there are some other developmental learning disabilities that are like that too. And sometimes girls get identified with more serious impairments, and it might be important that, again, to keep in mind that it's very important to do epidemiological research where you're following children at risk by birth cohorts and looking at the increase of the new cases of the disorder and tracking it by year by year. My understanding is that the CDC in their Atlanta surveillance program has included autism as one of the risk conditions, and they will be giving certain rates that will give us some data on this, but they're not actually directly examining the kids. They're actually doing a surveillance of this, and that information I think will be very useful too, because it's not just based on service delivery in special needs settings. So there's a lot of homework to be done.
Yeah, indeed, and we haven't even talked about genomic medicine as a treatment, as a cure. I wonder, Karen Cerussi, what it does to you to have first put yourself through the understanding that you hadn't done this, then to sort of fix on genetic predisposition, which was until very recently the culprit, and now to discover that you have functionally a happy, normal child in which whatever genetic disposition there was doesn't govern.
Well, you know, once again, I can't just, as Dr. Munir pointed out, my son is only one child, but luckily, because I run this international support organization, and because I've been getting over 400 emails a day for the last, I'd say, 4 months, and probably 200 emails a day for the year leading up until that, I am hearing from a lot of parents, and at least for most of these kids, I got to tell you, they're not behaviorally challenged children. They're physically ill children with some kind of systems breakdown that's affecting their metabolism, their immune system, their ability to tolerate a variety of foods. Many of them are multiply allergic. It's just so frustrating for me to sit here and listen to, you know, once again, another person say, well, these children need good educational services, and we need to follow them for 20 years and find out what's wrong with their brains and maybe do some genetic studies. There are a lot of genetic studies out there. They seem to have attributed autism to every single gene in our genome, except for maybe one or two. And I'd really just like to speak to other parents who might be listening today and say, I'm not telling you not to trust your doctors. I'm not telling you not to vaccinate your children. But if there's any way you can get on the internet and start doing some research and look at the studies that are out there, and if you could look at your children's physical illnesses, forget about the fact that they're children with autism. They're also children. And if they've got a distended belly and chronic diarrhea, don't let your doctor say, well, you know, he's just got that wacky autism, and there's nothing we can do about it. It's actually got a name. It's called chronic nonspecific diarrhea. You know, please pay your copay on the way out the door. These are children that need to be treated for their health impairments, and most of the time, they will have a behavioral response to that, which can be quite dramatic. And it's not because of food allergies. Yes, my son has food allergies.
Karen Cerussi's book is Autism and Pervasive Developmental Disorders. You're listening to The Connection. We haven't even spoken of the enormous challenge of internet medicine, in which, it's sort of like a few parents in the clinic corridor, but now it's thousands of parents worldwide forming a kind of critical mass, not necessarily against their doctors, but in a sort of balance. I hope you can see, Karen Cerusi, that there's a kind of there can be a conspiratorial tone, a kind of danger in that. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm sorry, because I don't actually think that there's any kind of conspiracy. I have two of my siblings are MDs, and my husband's a serious research scientist, and I understand how the channels of medicine work and of research work, but it can be very frustrating when you've seen something that works so well for your child, and when you tell another parent to try it, and they say, I can't because my doctor told me it won't work. It's just very frustrating. It's not so hard to believe that autism may be very different from what people who have been studying it for many years think it is. It really may be a metabolic or an immunological disorder, and we have so much evidence of that now that seems to be ignored. It can be so frustrating sometimes.
I think, Chris, the issue of the Internet actually is very positive in many respects. I think that when you look at many sites and many organizations that have evolved that have sites on the Internet, like the National Alliance of Autism Research is one, and the Cure Autism Now Foundation, the Defeat Autism Now, which is actually a foundation that has worked with Karen and is represented in the book, as well as the National Autism Society of Great Britain and other organizations, nationally Autism Society of America. They all have sites where they actually provide a lot of useful information for parents, in addition to many of the medical organizations and medical societies that have outlets in this respect. But beyond that, I think the Internet provides a lot of useful information among a sort of a sea of information that needs to be evaluated. And it's very important for parents to work collaboratively with this interdisciplinary group, as I tried to describe, of care providers in seeping through this and sorting this information at a time which is very difficult. But I also want to emphasize that it needs to be done very quickly, and that each child needs to be assessed as to their strengths as well as their weaknesses. And all sorts of possibilities need to be explored, including immune problems as well as allergies. And I think that every aspect of the child, and we actually do a physical exam as well as assessment of genetic as well as metabolic factors, and we have all sorts of specialists in our team at Children's Hospital that see the patient and come up with a collaborative plan to rule out all sorts of underlying issues that are very relevant.
1-800-423-8255. Catherine is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Catherine.
Hi. I'm calling from the New England Center for Children, and I just wanted to take a few moments. While I appreciate, of course, the work that Karen Cerusi has done with her son and the references that she's provided for parents in this area, we also want to say that the Internet does provide a wealth of information for parents, but it also provides a wealth of misinformation for them. And we would really like to caution parents In our judgment, you know, we would caution them to pick interventions whose effectiveness has been established in multiple scientific studies that have been published in professional journals, and we would really encourage them to steer clear of some of the rest of them.
But steer clear of what in particular, Catherine? How do you know the quackery?
Things such as the diet therapies, the vitamin therapies, some of the hormone therapies, therapies where there really is not enough adequate evidence to support the effectiveness of the use.
Okay, there's the warning. Karen Cerusi, what's your response?
Yeah, these studies are going to be out there in 5 or 6 or 7 years. They're going to say, you know what? Gee, there do seem to be children whose autism is caused by the abnormal breakdown of gluten and casein. And I'm sorry you were waiting for the results of the study. Your kid is now 8, 9 years old, and there's not a heck of a lot we can do for him. I think we're not talking about something expensive, invasive, in any way dangerous or life-threatening. We're talking about removing 2 proteins from the diet of a child who may or may not respond. And clearly, what I always tell parents is that you do this 100% for 3 months. And if you don't see any improvement at that time, and you reintroduce those foods, and you don't see any kind of regression, then your child is simply not in the subgroup of children who will respond to this.
Dr. Munir, you get the last word.
Well, I think that this explosion of information on the Internet and also the increase in rates will lead us to more research, and I'm sure that in the near future there will be more fruitful findings, and I think that we all need to work collaboratively, listen to parents in our research, formulate new questions.
There'll be more connection programs on it, too. Thank you. This is enormously interesting. Dr. Karim Munir from the Children's Hospital, Karen Cerusi, who wrote the book, Autism, unraveling the mystery of autism and pervasive developmental disorder. Thanks to the listeners and the callers, too. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by NextMonet.com, hundreds of artists, thousands of original artworks, and a whole new way to bring them home. Carefully selected by NextMonet.com, the online contemporary art.